Okay, Jeff, I want to talk about the guidelines you send your clients to try to prep the Pro Tool sessions or the media files that they send to you for mixing. So I got the latest email version here. And maybe you can tell me a little bit about the history of why you created this and how it evolved over time.
I created it because I was mixing so many records that it came to a point of where I needed some sort of standardization. And I was doing so much clerical work before I could even listen to the song just to get the tracks ready that I was realizing that it was taking energy away from just doing fun mix stuff, the kind of stuff that my clients were more interested in. And sometimes this stuff was taking me a couple hours if the session was really unorganized. So I decided, since I had a system, that maybe it was time to let my clients know what that system was. Sometimes if the sessions were really big, I would give my clients a discount on the mix rate if they would follow this stuff exactly and really set it up for me, because it was going to take me an hour and a half to do it. So I've worked that out with some people sometimes because the sessions are so large and such a high track count.
So after you have the session prepped according to your preferences and your specs, how does that improve your workflow?
Well, the main thing that helps me is the color coding, because I've been using these same colors for so long that I can just look at a large session. And when I say large, I'm talking like 60, 80 tracks. And I can immediately see where the lead vocal is without having to even look at what's typed in the track name. So that helps me immensely, just to know there's this section here in this mix and it's all different colors of blue. Those are all my guitars. And these red tracks are my drums. These orange tracks or percussion. And that has made, especially working on larger sessions, much more pleasurable and quicker, because I don't have to keep reading what I'm looking at or try to memorize where something is.
So Jeff, when you're setting your fees and your prices for doing mixes, that's one of the things you take into consideration, how much time you might have to invest in prepping the session to get it ready to mix. And also, sometimes, do you ever hire a mix assistant to help prep these for you?
I've had assistants in the past, but I'm so particular about my setup that it wasn't working out very well, and just passing them the sessions and then getting them back from them. And usually these assistants had other jobs, and sometimes I'd need a song and they didn't have it ready yet, which wasn't really their fault. I just found it was more streamlined for me to do it, and I've gotten quicker at it. So at some point, it'd be nice to have an assistant again. There was nice parts of that. But when it comes down to the submixing stuff that I do, I was trying to trust the assistants to make judgment calls on that, and it wasn't working out well.
Before we dig into the specifics of your list here, are your clients actually able to follow this list and deliver to your specifications?
It depends. I mean, some of my clients are very Pro Tools savvy. Some of my clients are better on Pro Tools than I am. Some of my clients aren't. I tried to pretend when I made the list that I didn't know anything about Pro Tools, and I tried to explain stuff as completely as I possibly could. So if someone was just opening up the program for the first time, they could at least follow through what I was saying. But yeah, I mean, my clients sometimes have questions. I'm working with a client now who needs clarification on stuff, needs me to tell him some quick key commands to get to certain things. So it varies. And then some of my clients don't use Pro Tools. So in that case, I just get a folder full of files, consolidated files. So then it makes this list meaningless, because only about 60% of my clients use Pro Tools. A lot of my clients use other platforms, Logic, Reaper. So this is just for people that have Pro Tools and if they're going to prep a Pro Tools session for me.
So Jeff, have you ever considered asking them to name the audio files the way you'd like to have your tracks named?
I haven't. That's a good idea.
I noticed in some of the sessions that you prep that you leave the clip names as they are and you just rename the tracks. And one of the things that I do a lot is after I rename the tracks, I'll consolidate the clips, and so the clip name will be inherited from the track name and it keeps it the same.
Well, that's a good comment. And the reason I keep the clip names the same is so I can still have a conversation with my client. If they're saying a certain guitar is too loud and they're calling it by a name, at least if I keep the clip name the same, I still have their original name, so I know what they're talking about. I don't like to change the file names, because then sometimes my file name might be so far off from what they're trying to describe to me.
That's interesting, because for me, in my workflow, that's one of the fundamental steps for me. Me is renaming the files so that all the files in the audio file folder are exactly how I want them to be. And then I'll communicate that to the client. And by the way, before we delve into this list, how frequently do you allow your clients to have access to the Pro Tools session file? Do you freely return that to them, or do you guard that because of all of the plugin and automation information, the intellectual property, or do you find that your clients don't really care anyway?
Very few clients ask for their Pro Tools sessions. I'm usually the one saying, hey, you should have these. It all depends on the situation. If there's been like a mix shootout where the client has had six or seven people mix a song to try to decide on who they're going to go with, if they want my Pro Tools session back, I'll usually strip out my plugins because, yeah, I wouldn't want, especially if I did it for spec. If they've paid me, I feel like they have a right to some of that work that I've done because they've paid me. I mean, I have so many plugins and I use my mixer that it'd be very difficult for someone to just recall the mix and to just run it anyway. If my clients have paid me and they were fair about the payment, I don't mind giving them the Pro Tools session back. I don't mind people looking at what I've done with work because it doesn't really matter, because if I've done something on a bass guitar in a song, I'm not going to do the same thing on another song. It only pertains to that session, so I'm not really worried about that.
I know some mix engineers, they have two rates, and one is just the WAV file, and the other is the full Pro Tools session. And if you want the full Pro Tools session, they charge extra money, sometimes a lot more money, actually, for that. Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we look at this list, and let's just go through the different sections, and you don't need to read it verbatim, but I'd like to get your kind of like annotation to fill in and explain what these are. So the first thing you want to make sure is that they create a rough mix MP3 and include it in the session. So tell us why you want that.
Oh, well, I just want to hear the last thing that they were listening to. And even though the mix is not perfect, I get a sense of how they were feeling it. What if there's a lot of different instruments, a lot of different guitars, I get a sense of like, what were the guitars that they're hearing as being loudest? I reference that mix a lot. A lot of the time it ends up being a lifeline because I'll determine things are missing. I'm working on a project now where I listen to the rough mix and I'm hearing harmonies that I don't have in the session. And then I'll get back to the client and say, hey, I'm missing some stuff. And then we'll sort that out. So it's just my window into the thing they were listening to when they decided, hey, let's call Jeff now and have him mix this, or let's call someone and have them mix this. This is where they were at. And it helps me a lot. In fact, if they forget to do that, I will contact them and say, please send me a rough mix. I need to have that.
I know one of the ways you like to mix is to have your mixes actually printed in the Pro Tools session as a stereo audio track, and you'll often name the different mixes and versions as a playlist so that all of your mixes are internal. And we can talk about bounce to disc versus printing internally. But for the reference mixes, do you like to have them in your Pro Tools session so you can play the rough reference mix directly from the Pro Tools session?
In my record track where I document my mix, I put the rough as a playlisted item in there, and I just call it rough. That way, when I'm monitoring through my final record track, all I have to do is take it out of input and their rough mix is there. And if it's not lined up with my session, I'll make sure it's lined up so that when I'm listening to specific parts of the song, it's always matched up. Most of my clients' rough mixes are rough with a capital R. I know that guys that might work on a higher level where the record's been made in a big studio and they're using an engineer who's like a veteran, that might be a different story, and those rough mixes are probably have a little more weight as far as the fidelity goes. But yeah, if it's a WAV, that'd be fine too.
Oh, I know something I wanted to ask you about, Jeff. Sometimes when clients asked to do mix shootouts, the idea of mixers to do a mix shootout so that there could be a handful of mixers who were gunning to be hired to mix an album so that the artist or the record label, the A&R person, takes a multi-track and sends it out to mixers. This is something that wasn't done as much back in the early days because everybody is so busy and it would be cost prohibitive. But now I've noticed it's a very competitive market where sometimes you can be sending out things to Andrew Sheps and Tony Maserati and Chad Blake, and hey, you guys, I'll mix it. And even sometimes there's a little bit of seed capital where there's a little budget where they'll pay a modest fee just to get an idea. And I've heard of like some really big mixers like, you know, Dave Pensado or whatever, really busy people who have to go through this process now. Can you share a little bit about, you know, what it's like for you when people ask you to do that and what's the deal?
Oh, well, it's basically what you described. I mean, it's a client that they've been referred to a number of mixers, and I can see where for the client it'd be a good thing because you can only get so much information listening to that engineer's work. It doesn't really apply to your own record. I don't really do mixes on spec, but usually there's a small amount. So if they have the budget to like pay all these mixers to do it, it probably is pretty interesting to hear how each of these people handles their song. Yeah. I mean, as an artist, I think that would be a great thing. As a mixer, it's a little bit of a game show and it's kind of nerve-wracking. And I usually don't want to know who else is in the lineup because that'll make me more nervous. But, you know, you just do the best you can. And then, and sometimes I've gotten the gig. Sometimes they've told me I was their second best. But, yeah, it's nerve-wracking.
Hey, when it comes back to reference mixes, one of the things that I really teach in my classes is the importance of reference mixes, or basically the importance of listening. You and I have already talked about that, the importance of listening and having your speakers together and your listening environment together and maybe having your ears tested. The value of reference mixes for up-and-coming mix engineers is having stuff that you're familiar with, so when you play it back on some speakers, you know what it sounds like. For example, the more you listen to a certain mix, the more valuable it becomes if you log in a lot of time. And some of my reference mixes are actually some pretty old music, like an old Steely Dan song that Roger Nichols mixed 20 years ago. Like, I know that so well. I have a lot of listening time invested in it. But my question to you is, can you confirm that you appreciate if the client can provide some reference mixes that might be representative of some things that they'd like you to achieve in the mix work that you're going to do for them? And it might be, I like this song because the way the vocals sound, or I like this song because it sounds really big, or because it sounds really small and intimate, or I really love the reverb on this snare drum, or maybe I just like the vibe of this. And can you tell me some of the instances where you appreciate that clients provide you some reference mixes before you start doing the work?
This is a good point you're bringing up, and I actually ask my clients for reference mixes, yes. I tell them to give me 4 or 5 songs. I tell them that it doesn't have to be exactly what you want your record to sound like or anything. It just is more like something you like the vibe of, or something like, I like the vocal reverb on this song, even though I don't like the way the drums sound, or I like the way the electric guitars sit in these mixes, even though it's a country song and we're doing hard rock. So stuff like that can help me a lot, because especially if you mix all different kinds of stuff like I do, it's essential to know where your clients are at, because especially if you're being paid by the song, you want to keep the artistic dance between you and your clients down to a minimum, because it starts not being in your best interest to spend more time if you're being paid by the song. So the more I know about my client's aesthetic checklist, the smoother the project goes. Because some of my clients love reverb. Some of my clients won't even let me say reverb. And I need to know this stuff, because a mix can be 1,000 different things, obviously. And I want to get it down to maybe 2 things it can be instead of the 1,000. I want to cut out the 998 other possibilities so that we start making a record and it feels like we're going somewhere together, the client and I.
Can I prompt the witness here and get a quote from you? Something to the extent of, when I'm working on a mix, sometimes I listen to a reference mix just to compare my mix to see if I'm in the zone quality control wise, or clean my ears out, clean my palate as it were, something to that extent.
Yeah, I AB a lot. I try not to AB at first because I think that'll just be confusing, but I AB kind of in the 11th hour, so to speak. If my client has provided reference mixes for me, I'll AB with those. And then also maybe I'll AB with something I like. The low end in my room is a little tricky, so some of the referencing I do is just to make sure that I'm not wimping out in the low end, that I'm pushing stuff hard enough. I was going to say, and I'm not endorsing this product, but there's a brilliant plugin. You can cut this out if I'm not supposed to talk about products, but there's a brilliant plugin called Metric AB that Plugin Alliance sells that is the best way to reference your mix against a mix from the outside world. And it has all kinds of metering. It shows comparative RTA, real-time analysis of the frequency spectrum of the two songs, the one you're working on, and the reference. And you can actually enter in, I think, up to 10 reference songs, and it'll level match for you. You just play your song in like a loud section and play and hit match, and it'll like turn down the mastered song. It's brilliant. And it's got very advanced metering. I use it now in my mastering. I don't use it for the AB purposes, but I use it just because the metering in it is so good. And it has phase correlation compared to the song you're listening to, dynamics compared to the song you're listening to. It's a really great plugin. Like if I was starting out mixing, I think that'd be one of the first plugins I'd buy because it's so great. And then you just put it on your master fader and it has this big yellow AB button and you just click on that and it flips back and forth between what you're working on and a song from the outside world that is level matched. And you can look at the very detailed frequency spectrum analysis and see like, oh, wow, there's way more subs going on in this song that I'm referencing. I better like beef up some stuff below, you know, 60. It's great for that. I know there's been other plugins that do that, but this one is like great Swiss Army knife. It's great to check phase. It's like I said, it works even great just as a utility program, aside from the ABing function that it does, because it's got such good metering.
As a mix engineer, you have your own reference mixes that you like to listen to, that you AB, that are part of your collection. Are you aware of the name of the mix engineers a lot of times when you're listening to a great mix? Are you like, who mixed that? And then do you find out the credits of who mixed that song?
Well, on the stuff that I have that I reference of the music I like, I know the mix engineers. But when people provide me with stuff and I put it on, I'm like, wow, that's really good. Who did this? That's when I'll do a little research. And that's a whole nother podcast there is... Sometimes it takes a long time to find out who made some of these records. The documentation's really bad right now.
Yeah, I've noticed that too myself. I appreciate having the credits on the back of a CD. And then this day and age, if you want to find those credits, sometimes you got to go looking and you might get lucky. It might be on Wikipedia or AllMusic or some of the different databases. But so off the top of your head, who are some of your favorite mix engineers?
Oh, geez. You and I have talked about, I like Chad Blake a lot. I've been following Chad Blake's work for 30 years now and have watched him grow as an artist and change. You know, it's funny because I, even though I'm not really into hard rock, I think his name is Joe Baumgartner. I know that's his last name. I can't remember his first name. I think it was through some clients' reference mixes that I became aware. He's a really great mixer and he's all in the box. I'm extremely interested in guys that are working inside the box, because I'm mostly doing that. So I like to level the playing field a little bit. I like Nigel Godrich's work. I mean, I don't listen to a lot of big pop stuff. How do you say his name? Serban?
Oh, Serban Gania.
Yeah. What was I referencing?
He's amazing. I mean, regardless of the genre, and of course, he's mostly mixing pop music because that's where the money is. And I'm sure he's like already booked 2 years in advance by major record labels.
Right.
His mixes have so much clarity to them. They're just really amazing. When you listen to a Serban Gania mix, it really sounds like his signature in the mix. The DNA is sculpted in a way that only he can do. And he's in the box too.
He's in the box too, yeah.
Yeah. Chad Blake is in the box 100%.
Chad Blake's
he doesn't
in the
use
box,
any
100%.
External sub mixing.
Yeah. Doesn't even use summing, Chad Blake.
Yeah, exactly.
So I really like Sean Everett's work. He's this younger guy that I guess I like some of the more guys that like push things more because that makes my mixes better. There's a lot of mixers that are good, but they don't really push me. Whereas if I listen to a Chad Blake mix, it always just pushes me to like go a little farther out in space maybe than what I would normally do. He inspires me that way, even though I've never met him.
Okay, here's my last question before we get into the actual laundry list of how to prep a session. I want to talk to you about the difference between a mix engineer and a producer. One of the reasons is you just mentioned about pushing things. And, you know, I think this day and age, I'm sure you'll agree that the division between producer and mix engineer has really blurred. The reason I'm asking is because some of the mixes that I'm going to be sending you really soon as we can train my clients to prep the sessions according to your specs, and of course I will help them. Some of these clients, some of these artists, are really looking to the mixer to make some decisions and do things with their tracks that they cannot envision. And so they really want to have a mix engineer come to the table who is going to surprise them by, in essence, being a producer. In my definition, the minute you start either changing the arrangement or maybe moving things around or maybe even adding some stuff. It's interesting, Chad Blake often, he's famous for actually programming some drum parts in addition to the mix stuff that he received. Some artists that I'm working with, they talk about how they have really appreciated the mix engineers doing things with their tracks that they never dreamed of doing. So I want to have your thoughts on producer versus mix engineer.
Yeah, well, what's happened, sadly, is that in the hierarchy of making records, producers have kind of gotten squeezed out of the calculation because, well...
Can I please have you define a producer?
Oh, well, a producer on a record is different than a producer on a movie. A producer on a record is more analogous to a director of a film. It is the person that is working with the artist, and it is a person that understands how a studio works, but also understands how a song works and understands music theory, but then also has a vision for how the whole record will sound. He helps the band figure out what they're going for through the arc of a record, or a good producer does that and says, this is the kind of record I think we should make. Let's do it. And maybe the band says, well, that's cool, but we want to do this. They kind of figure this out beforehand. And so then when the producer walks into a studio with a band, that producer kind of knows where they're going, from how the drums are going to be recorded, how the guitars are going to be recorded, how much detail work to get into as far as tightening things up. Are we making like a loose old rock record, or are we going for something that's more postmodern and kind of perfect? And the producer, or a good producer, understands all these things that I just listed. Plus, they have very good interpersonal skills. They're able to make the band feel good. They're able to get the best performances out of members of the band. They work in such a way where people don't feel intimidated, because that just closes off creativity. So it's a lot of things. A good producer is a lot of different things. And they're usually musicians in their own right, and they usually have really good ideas about arrangements. They'll know if a song has too many choruses, or if an intro is too long, or an intro should just be cut out, or if the song should fade, or should it have a cold stop. A good producer helps the band, because the band's kind of busy writing the songs, writing lyrics, figuring out parts. And so it's good to have one person who's outside of it, who's not sitting there with the band, who's sitting on the couch in the control room, listening to everything going down and saying, that was great, but we're going to take the bridge from the take you did before. But that was so great. You know, the band needs that. But unfortunately, that job has started to go away, because a lot of people make their own records. And for a lot of younger artists who buy software and a nice microphone and some instruments, they're like, why do I need some guy to tell me like how my music should be? I can do that. And I think people will make a record that way and then realize I should have had some help. Also, a producer, the money part of it in the music industry is kind of nebulous these days, because a lot of producers used to work mostly for points, but now that gets a little weird because there are no points, because record sales are so low. So it's just become a strange shadow position. People still do it, obviously, and the really good producers are in demand. And there's producers, there's guys like Rick Rubin. He just comes in once a week, sits on the couch. The band and the engineer, you know, Rick Rubin has this team of engineers that he trusts. They play him what they've done that week. He says, this is good, this is good. You got to do that again. This needs to be a faster tempo. And then he leaves. And then he comes back the next week and they play it for him again. And there's guys like that. He's very kind of hands off. He's not in the vocal booth with the artist prompting every phrase from them like some producers are. So there's different styles too.
Yeah, let's talk about the different types of producers. And Rick Rubin is a really good example. He is an example where we might say that he came up more as a music fan, and he's kind of a DJ, but he's really more a lover of music. He has really good taste, obviously. He's been able to make some great selections about what's going to be a hit in hip hop and rock, and he's done all different styles. But he's a kind of producer that evolved out of a music lover, and he has very good taste and aesthetics. He's also a really good organizer and team leader. talk about the kind of different types of producers, whether it's more of a music producer or more of like an audio engineer type producer.
There are audio engineers that are very musical people that maybe they'll have an idea like, hey, you should double this guitar. Their ideas and their take on the band's music isn't as inside of it. They may not have had these like long meetings where they've tried to decide what kind of record they're making, but the audio engineer as producer, which happens a lot now because, again, there's not a lot of producers that are actually in the hierarchy anymore. So a lot of engineers have had to kind of step up and say, hey, your guitar is out of tune, or you need to tune that rack tom because it's tuned to a very weird note as far as the key of this song. So a lot of engineers have had to really not just sit there and hit record because bands just need some guidance. It can be very overwhelming for a band to walk into a studio, especially a band that's never done it before, and they're scared, they're excited, there's lots of glowy lights and knobs. They're making a record, which is something that they have dreamed of all their life, and they have admired other people who have done that, and here they are doing it. And younger artists sometimes have skewed vision of what actually happens in the studio, and they think that certain types of gear, because they've read about that, is important. And sometimes it's good if there's someone there to say like, no, don't worry about that, this will be fine. Whatever just gets the band playing music and not having to worry about that stuff is always going to be in a band's best interest.
And now in your position, you're very qualified. You're a musician, you're a player, you're an artist, you're a songwriter, you understand music, you're an audio engineer, you can record stuff, you can be a producer. And when you're working with bands and you do have the opportunity to go into the studio and set stuff up, that's one thing. But a lot of your work is people just sending you files. Let's tie this back to prepping for a mix, quote unquote. So part of the thing that happens when you prep a mix and you get things all cleaned up and everything's labeled and color-coded and stuff, then you might have a perspective on these files. There might be an opportunity for you to put on your producer's hat and comment to the band, like, for example, you know, if you did this or that, it might improve the overall track before I mix it. What's been your experience with that?
Well, it can get kind of slippery because I'm coming in toward the end of the project. So I have to be very careful because I want to make sure people keep their enthusiasm about what they're doing. There's no point in someone getting tracks and saying, I can't work with this. I mean, that's just not going to help anybody. And that's going to make the band feel bad, or the client, whether it's a band or not.
So how about this, Jeff? Do you ever take it upon yourself to creatively explore or do an iteration that might be adding or changing things to a point where you think it might be cool, and then kind of sending it back to the client and saying, what do you think? Which is more than just balancing and adding EQ. You actually really are producing it. Do you ever do that as a potential option to discuss?
Well, I can't help it. If I hear that there's two guitar parts that are working against each other in an arrangement, I'm probably going to mute one. I always tell the client what I'm doing because, to use a Star Trek analogy, they're Captain Kirk and I'm like Scotty, you know, at best. So they have the right to refuse that I do that. Most of the time they're happy about it. I very rarely will play something on someone's song unless I have an idea and I know it'll make it stronger. And again, I always tell the client, hey, I added this, I just want you to know.
Do you ever overdub glockenspiel parts and mix them really back in the mix and don't tell the client about it? Or do you put any backward masking subliminal words telling them they should pay you more money?
There's backwards masking going all throughout this podcast, actually. So I use that all the time. I have a story about that, but I can't tell it. Maybe I'll tell you off record. I'll tell you off the record. But seriously, unless the artist has said to me, we'd like you to mix this, but we also, if you have, and this happens all the time, people say this to me, if you have any ideas, add them or tell us, if that dialogue opens up. But I look at my role in the music making process so differently than I did 25, 30 years ago. You know, at this point, I want to serve my client. If my clients have come to me with music that they think sounds great, I am not going to A, tell them it doesn't, or B, say like, I'm going to blow blues harmonica all over this. It's going to make it better. I mean, there's just no way I'm going to do that. But if the clients do come to me in the initial stages and say, we made this record, we're kind of happy with it, but we're wondering if some of these songs, maybe the arrangements could use some help. So if you have any ideas, please do your thing. And when that happens, that's when I feel like I've been invited to be part of the music making process. But even if the client hasn't said that, it's hard for me to not, if I hear two musical parts that are rubbing, or to me, there's a section where there's just one too many things going on. Because, you know, part of what I'm doing when I'm mixing is I'm trying to just tap into that 15-year-old rock fan in my brain. And instead of thinking about plugins and technical things, and do I have enough 600 hertz in the drum overheads or whatever, part of what I'm doing is I'm trying to just go like, is this cool? Is this neat? I'm trying to tap into that part of me that listened to music when I used to buy records after mowing the lawn. I used to go to the record store and I'd be able to buy one record a month. And I put that record on and it would just be this, how did that even happen? How did humans make music sound like that? How does a snare drum sound like that? Or what is a snare drum or whatever? I try to get into that mode of my brain. And that's when I say, like, the fact that there's five different vocal melodies going on here is not neat and not cool, at least for me. I'm going to cut some and see what they say. And if they say, oh my God, this sounds so much better, then great. If they say, well, we kind of like those, then I'll put them back. It's not my record, but I will take a stab usually. I won't go too far, especially if I haven't been invited, because I don't want to cause more work for the client. I don't want to cause more work for myself. It becomes a conflict of interest. And if, like I said, if the client is super happy with what they have, most of the time, though, most of the people that approach me kind of know what I do and they want my help with stuff. They need a backseat producer. It's harder to do things. I mean, obviously, with Pro Tools, you can do a lot of fantastic things at the very end of a record making process, but you can't change the way something was tracked. You can't change the performances, really. A lot of times you just have to make do with what you have. And that's part of the challenge of mixing is, okay, here's this stuff. It's just like editing a movie. You know, if you're an editor, the director hands you all this film. You're like, okay, let's make a movie of this now. You know, it's just all these shots of people talking and you have to put it together. It's the same thing with mixing a record. Sometimes it's easier to put the record together. Some of my clients are brilliant producers on their own. I work with this band called Typhoon here in Portland, and Kyle, the lead singer-songwriter, is an amazing producer. I get the stuff from him. It's not always like recorded in a perfect Abbey Road pristine manner, but it just all fits together. So easy to mix. Even though they're huge sessions and they're these epic songs, they just all fit together because he hears it. And he's never taken lessons or anything. He just kind of knows how a pop record's supposed to, it's just something that's innate. He's a young guy. So I have some clients that are like that. And also, when you're mixing, if there is a producer attached or the artist is the acting producer and they know what they're doing, it makes it so much easier to mix because then you can have discussions and the producer kind of knows exactly what they want. And the notes you get when after you send in your first revision are very succinct and very clear. And, you know, I work with Steve Berlin a lot. He's in Los Lobos and has produced more records than I own. And working with him is such a pleasure because he's just been doing it for like 40 years and I get notes from him. They're very clear. It's never like, could the bridge sound more like the sun or something like that, which for a mixer, that's really tough. And sometimes you get direction like that. And actually I'm pretty good at translating those kind of things too, but it's always better when there's someone in charge, someone who's like, this is the record we're making. These are the sounds that are part of the palette of this record. And this is what it's going to be. And let's mix this. That's always a lot more fun. The record ends up being better. I've seen it.
Yeah, those are great answers, Jeff. And also a great segue into why you prep your mixes the way you do so you can do your job with all the stuff you just talked about by organizing things and prepping your session the way you want to see it. That allows you to do the level of work.